Coming up on Weekend America.
Deep below the streets of St. Louis, Johnny is riding his bike.
You were saying about that noise?
Sometimes we'll hear a noise, sort of like that that thumping noise on Law & Order. It always creeps people out.
Another thing that's creepy, the state of repair he sees down there. I'm John Moe. Also, if it's too cold to golf, why not learn to curl?
So now we're just going to shove the rock just a very slow speed, and you just sweep in front of it and don't fall the rock. Okay, sweep, sweep, come on, hurry, hard, come on, hurry.
Hey, it's harder than it looks, especially with that guy yelling at me. And given where Kareem grew up, his choice of music is pretty normal.
Country music's like crickets, you know, in Oklahoma. It's just there. I mean, you don't really know. It's not really whether you like it or you don't. It's just part of the culture.
Still, you don't see too many country singers who are also Muslims. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul, where winter is upon us. But folks around here, they don't run and hide just because it's cold out. No, no, they exercise. All over the city, ice rinks are going up. In parks, there's one downtown here. People are getting ready to play hockey or broomball, which is kind of like hockey, and they curl. You've seen curling, right? Big iron-looking stones sliding across the ice, aimed toward targets, people frantically sweeping in front of the stones. Well, this hour, I learned to curl. It's harder than it looks, especially the sweeping. When you think of winter, what comes to mind?
Beautiful, fresh, cool mornings in Colorado with the magnificent, you know, the snow on the mountains.
It's nice to go snowshoeing.
I think winter is freaking cold, and if it wasn't so cold, it would actually be a great season.
I love it when the outdoors is cold and blustery, and really here in the Northwest, we just get a different kind of winter.
The first year I got my pet dog, got him for Christmas, and we brought him to Prospect Park, and the big open field with all the snow, and he was running around having a lot of fun.
Those voices came from Denver, Chicago, Brooklyn, and Portland, Oregon. It was another rough week for the economy. Nice bump on the stock market yesterday, but still, the auto industry is flailing. Unemployment figures are way up, like giant type on the front page kind of up. And this week, we found out that we're in a recession. You probably suspected as much, I'm thinking, but on Monday, the National Bureau of Economic Research said the recession is upon us, and in fact, it started a year ago. Dan Ariely is a behavioral economist at Duke University. He specializes in irrationality. Perfect. He's a regular commentator on American Public Media's Marketplace and author of the book Predictably Irrational. Hi, Dan.
Hello, hello.
What effect does this declaration of the recession have on people in this economy?
So it's interesting that, you know, seven economists get together and say that, oops, for the last year we've been in a recession. And in some sense, it shouldn't be any news because it's something about the past. But it does change people's psychology in a very deep way. And even though nothing has changed in any meaningful way in the economy, the fear, the extra fear that this word has on us is likely to get us more into the depths of recessions.
So are you afraid of the economy, or are you afraid of fear itself, as a former president might say?
Yeah, so, you know, there's no question that the bad things about the economy, but on top of that, I think that the fear itself is going to make things much, much worse. And you can think of this as basically a coordination game. If all of us decide that we're afraid, and all of us decide to spend 10% less and give less loan and put less money in the stock market and keep more cash, all of us are going to suffer together with this.
Well, so how do you find that balance then? Because, you know, we're told to save, we're told to spend, and it seems like if we do too much of either one, it's the psychology and the anxiety that's creating problems.
That's right. So there's actually not a single solution for everybody. You know, this is a misleading thing that everybody should do the same thing. There are people, regrettably, who are doing very badly and that will do even worse under this economy. And those people need to think very carefully about how they're going to change their lifestyle and demands and financial situations and manage in these rough few years that are ahead of us. The people that have lost paper money, that don't need this money on a daily basis, but have lost money that will serve them at retirement, they should not get panicked over it. They shouldn't say to themselves, because I've lost 20% of my portfolio, 40% of my portfolio, which will be relevant for me in 35 years, let me stop spending now. Now, we should never overspend, but we shouldn't get into a panic either for the people who are not in a dire situation right now.
Do we have the capacity through psychology and behavior and anxiety management to right the course on the economy? Like, how powerful are our minds and our fears in this situation?
So it's two things. One, it's our minds and fears, and it's very hard to overcome fear because fear is invoked by the outside world. And once it's invoked, it's very hard to turn it off. It's very hard to say, I'm not afraid. You know, my wife and I were going for the first time since we got married, which was 10 years ago, on vacation next month. And with all these words, we were thinking, you know, should we change our vacation plans? And the truth is that we are okay. We've lost like everybody else, but the chances that we would lose our jobs are very small. And how much should we sacrifice on the day-by-day level is not clear. But this fear does make us want to do something, react, take whatever steps are reasonable. But the fear is we'll take too many of these steps and actually decrease our quality of life too much.
Dan Ariely, behavioral economist at Duke University. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
This week in Missouri, a voter-approved constitutional amendment goes into effect to help cities in that state free up more money for drainage projects. Reporter Adam Allington saw that measure in the voting booth on Election Day, and like a lot of people facing wordy ballot measures, he had questions. How will that money be used? Why do we need it? What does the measure even mean? So, in an effort to get some answers, Adam did a little urban spelunking. He ventured into the miles of storm drains running underneath Columbia, Missouri, and he brought a guide to help him find his way.
I met him in a drainage ditch just off Interstate 70.
My name is Johnny Tarr.
Johnny Tarr is not his real name, but what we're about to do isn't exactly legal.
We're facing towards the Columbia Mall and its various parking lots, and we'll head into this storm drain that services all these parking lots.
Johnny has the kind of reckless curiosity your mom warned you about when you were a kid, always sneaking into places he shouldn't. Instead of taking the street, he likes to ride his bike underground through a maze of storm drains and tunnels.
From where I sit, I think of this as a public work, similar to a sidewalk, and it should be our right to access it if we feel like it, because, you know, we're paying for it.
We crawl through the first pipe, and eventually we spill into a larger tunnel made of concrete. It's pitch dark, wet, and strangely warm. Now, before I got into the drains, I was kind of excited about the idea of a little covert civic trespassing. But now that I'm actually here, it's terrifying. My tiny headlamp barely shines 3 feet in front of me. When my eyes finally adjust, one of the first things I notice is a plastic hospital bracelet floating in a pool at my feet. I try not to imagine how it got there.
You were saying about that noise?
Sometimes we'll hear a noise, sort of like that thumping noise on Law & Order. It always creeps people out, but what it is it's all cars driving over manhole covers, like this one over your head.
Eventually, I'm able to push my fear of a sewer-dwelling serial killer aside and look around. The tunnel itself's maybe 5 feet high, and not quite as Indiana Jones as I'd expected. More hallway than mineshaft.
This is all here just because we live in a world that water can't penetrate, and so it has to be flushed away.
When you pave over the Earth's ability to drain itself naturally, the water has to go somewhere. And because of that, every city, even ones in the desert, run the risk of flooding during storms.
To avoid a flood, they have to put the flood literally underground.
And eventually, that flood ends up where we're standing.
What we're seeing right here is a place where high water during floods, where this tunnel completely fills, has eroded the ceiling and the rebar is exposed and rusting and ultimately falling to the ground. And so we'll see bits of this on the floor as we go along.
Basically, stormwater systems are a transportation utility, a massive network of drains and pipes to move water away from buildings as quickly as possible. The problem is, all across the country, drains just like this one are falling apart. And since all this engineering is underground, the cost to repair and upgrade is massive. In fact, many engineers are busy designing systems that keep raindrops out of pipes altogether. After about 2 hours underground, we're still under the parking lot, but I figure we must have traveled well over a mile.
We're here under a gutter box, and we can see that there's an opening that exists where the sidewalk meets the streets, and that's where things pour down. A lot of pollutants get dumped down here, intentionally or unintentionally, via runoff.
The EPA ranks urban stormwater as the second leading source of water pollution in the country, and it's easy to see why. As Johnny and I continue deeper into the tunnel, small pipes pop out of the walls around us, each spewing out a kind of slippery, greasy silt.
There's some sort of slick stuff on the surface here, and we should really watch our step. Get this ooze coming down the wall. I try not to think about what it is.
What it is likely a mixture of antifreeze, heavy metals, oil, and salt from the parking lot above us. When we finally emerge into the light, near a quiet stream on the other side of the mall, Johnny points out where the sludge water we've been walking through flows freely into the creek.
You know, when the shock value of being underground and in a creepy place wears off, you realize, like, all the sick stuff you're looking at, you know, the disrepair, the money involved, who the stakeholders are. I mean, we're all stakeholders in this public works project. This is everybody's water, and it's going to everybody's tap.
I went into the drain tunnels because I wanted to understand what was so important about stormwater that my state actually put language about it into our state constitution. The answer I got back was that managing stormwater is extremely important, not just to keep our streets high and dry, but because sometimes keeping our streets dry means sending toxic runoff into the Missouri River, which continues on to St. Louis, where I live. And the idea of that oozy pipe sludge washing up in my backyard is much scarier than any creepy noises back in the tunnel. In Columbia, Missouri, I'm Adam Allington for Weekend America.
We have some pictures of the oozy pipe sludge. Pictures taken by Adam and by Johnny. You can see some of these older corrugated metal pipes collapsing, some of these urban spelunkers in these tunnels. That's all at our website. That story was part of Weekend America's ongoing series on our country's aging infrastructure. Does your town need fixing up? Go to weekendamerica.org and tell us about it.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
The next president of the United States will be African American. A discussion about Africans, Americans, and African Americans next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. It's been a month now since Barack Obama was elected president, and much of the discussion about that event has focused on what it means that an African American will hold the highest office in the land. Obama's lineage, however, is different than that of many African Americans. Obama has African ancestry, but his ancestors were never slaves in the United States. And according to psychologists, that can make a huge difference in how Black Americans see themselves. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper is doing a series of stories called Inside Blackness, examining what being Black in America today is like. Des spoke to New York Times correspondent Helene Cooper, a native of Liberia.
Helene, welcome to Weekend America.
Thanks for having me, Des.
Now, I want to start with a little conceit. You might have noticed that my last name is Cooper, and so is yours.
I saw that.
Yeah, and we both have roots back to Virginia, which you wouldn't know about. I can actually trace my father's family, the Cooper family, back to a plantation near Richmond in the 1800s. And your ancestors were free Blacks living in Norfolk, Virginia as well.
I trace my ancestors back to, there were five Cooper brothers that got on the ship in Norfolk in 1829.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. Your ancestors made a choice that mine didn't. Mine stayed in Virginia, and they're still there to this day. Tell me about the choice that your ancestors made.
They decided to get on a ship and go to Africa, to Liberia. They were part of this Back to Africa movement that had been started by the American Colonization Society at the turn of the century. And the American Colonization Society was a group of abolitionists from the North and a lot of slave owners from the South who sort of came up with this idea that you couldn't have freed Blacks living in the United States at the same time that enslaved Blacks were there. A lot of them were their mixed-race kids of these southern plantation owners, and they wanted them sort of out of sight.
And they also wanted free Blacks gone because they're out there making a living and living a free lifestyle, and that certainly can't be good for morale.
Exactly.
On the plantation. The freed Blacks who left the United States went to Africa and behaved pretty much like the white colonists had behaved.
They, in many ways, set up the same antebellum society that they had fled. And it was kind of humbling to realize that they're just how, in many ways, racist they were, and how it just sort of taught me that racism is sort of so much more universal than I had grown up believing it was.
And it's not a matter of skin color.
It's not. We're also capable of it.
Well, after the Civil War here in the United States, my set of Coopers continued to sharecrop. They struggled through Jim Crow. My father had 12 siblings. Out of them, only three, including him, graduated from high school. And he and his brother were the only two to get graduate degrees. How did your family fare in Liberia?
There were four Cooper brothers and one sister that got on board the ship in Norfolk in 1829. And they were all educated. They worked for the government. My grandfather was called Radio Cooper because he brought telecommunications to Liberia in the 1940s and 50s. And it was a very land-rich family. So that by the time that I was born, it was sort of assumed that, you know, I would go to the best schools and I would go to college, and we had a house and a farm and we had a villa in Spain, and we were as well off as very few Africans at the time were.
Well, if we fast forward a couple hundred years, here you and I are, both Coopers, both journalists.
It's so weird.
but I was really struck by a passage in your book that may go to the heart of something that's still very, very different about both of us. And I would like to ask you to read from page 29 of your book.
Okay. When presented the choice between America and Africa, they chose Africa. Because of that choice, I would not grow up 150 years later as an American Black girl, weighed down by racial stereotypes about welfare queens. Instead, those two men handed me a once-in-a-lifetime lottery ticket, birth into what passed for the landed gentry upper class of Africa's first independent country, Liberia. None of that American post-Civil War, civil rights movement baggage to bog me down with any inferiority complex about whether I was as good as white people. Who needs to struggle for equality? Let everybody else try to be equal to me.
Is that your point of view, that I've been burdened by a history that you've been free of?
There's no question in my mind. I'm an African-American woman, and anybody who sees me is immediately going to assume that I come with all of the history. And in many ways, I do. But I think I've had an easier time dealing with a lot of the racial baggage than perhaps you have, because I didn't have to deal with any of that until I was maybe 14. And by then, there was never any question in my mind that I was every bit as good as everybody else. When we first moved to the United States, after we left Liberia, I was 14. Mm-hmm. And I went to college in North Carolina. This was a couple of years later. And my freshman year in college, I had a roommate who was from a small town in North Carolina. She was white. And it turns out after a couple of months, she asked that she be moved because I found out later she didn't want to be rooming with somebody black. And I remember calling my father that night after I found out. And I was like, Daddy, Deanna doesn't want to room with me because I'm black. And he started laughing. And I started laughing, too. And it was this, like, it was one of my first experiences with racism, but they seemed so ridiculous. The idea that, you know, this girl didn't want a room with me because I was black, and his reaction.
Okay, I have to stop you there. I really have to stop you there, because the fact that you're laughing at that, and, you know, I had many of those kinds of experiences starting at the age of 4.
That's what I mean. That's my point. It's like having to live through with this. With this nonsense day after day.
And so you didn't feel hurt by that?
No, I felt like, what idiot, what stupid people. There were later times when I remember dating a white guy when I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. This was the love of my life, and his parents didn't want us. Ended up freaking out when they realized that we weren't just friends. We were actually mm-hmm. dating because they had been fine with me when I was just a friend. But when they realized that we were dating, they didn't want the idea of, you know, black grandchildren or whatever. And that sort of was my realization of just how much easier I had it. I hadn't lived with that when I was 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years old. I never had anybody implying in any way that there was something, you know, less about me because I was black.
I'm wondering, Helene, what part of you will always be Liberian and what part will be American?
You know, I'm always going to be both. In a lot of ways, I've always been both, you know, partly because my ancestors came from America. I'm too American at this point to ever be, you know, fully Liberian. But the Liberian in me didn't die. It's still there, and it's what makes me who I am.
Well, thank you, Helene. This has been wonderful.
Thanks a lot. This was really cool.
Helene Cooper is the author of The House at Sugar Beach, a book about her family's escape following a coup in Liberia. If you have a story you'd like to share for our series Inside Blackness, please drop us a line, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
Too cold and rainy to golf or play baseball or tennis, you know what that means. Time to curl. Join me as I try to put the rock in the house ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. That ding means it's time for your letters. The week before Thanksgiving, Sarah Kay Smith was a panelist on our Good News, Bad News, No News segment, and she made an offhand remark about kids these days that got a lot of attention in our show's online afterlife. Here's what listeners heard. Sites like Facebook and MySpace are helpful to teenagers because they help build social skills and internet literacy. Is this finding good news, bad news, or no news?
I would say that this is bad news in the sense that kids are basically illiterate today. And this will not help.
They are?
Yes. You have kids. Aren't they illiterate?
Well, no, my kids are not. The 7-month-old, yes, she prefers to chew books rather than read them. Anyway, Mary Beth Blegen, a longtime teacher from St. Paul, Minnesota, had this to say. Our kids are not illiterate. At some point, we who work with kids will figure out that we can't stay stuck in a time that has passed. We need to know who we are teaching and support their growth toward literacy. Kids are great. Let's ask them about their being illiterate. So that's what we did. Weekend America's Chris Wieg went to the Minneapolis Public Library's Teen Central, where he found some teens, and they had a lot to say about Sarah K. Smith's allegations.
Clearly, she doesn't go to a library. Yeah,
why do you say that?
I am here on a daily basis, and I cannot tell you how many people I see reading books.
This is manga. It's basically a comic book. This is like book one, or this is like book five out of like 13, 14. You know, it really gets up there.
These days, kids talk a lot through like text speak and chat speak and stuff like that, and kids really aren't illiterate. They just, when it comes to talking to each other, I mean, we just don't need to say all that stuff, and like, usually we just like simplify things.
People pick up books and read all the time, and there's a lot more reading that goes on in our day-to-day lives than a lot of people will give credit for. A lot of the times we're not picking up the newspaper to read. We're going online to CNN and looking at the stories and the live feeds on there.
You don't have to read a book to be literate. I've listened to Obama's speech when he became elected as president a total of like maybe 7 times.
What do you do when you listen to Obama's speech?
Well, I kind of like try to philosophically analyze the things that he says and why he says them. It's not so much as, I think he uses a lot of metaphors. There's actually a whole school day where we dedicated to listening and just thinking about the things that they said in those speeches.
A couple of weeks ago, Desiree Cooper did a story on Doug Merrill, a high school baseball coach who has lost several students to suicide over the years. Sonia Browers of Henderson, Nevada wrote to us, I listened to Week in America on my Saturday afternoon run. Please warn me ahead of time if you plan to air another story as sad as the one on survivors of suicide. I looked like such an idiot running down the sidewalk crying like a baby. Well, sorry, Sonia. Apparently, it's also embarrassing to listen to the funny bits of our show. Listener Jen Kinborn of Wooster, Ohio, heard me critiquing the grammar and poetry of the well-known Guns N' Roses song Sweet Child of Mine recently, and Jen wrote in to say, I listened to it in the car alone, so everyone who saw me drive by saw me cracking up by myself. Thanks for the laughs. And finally, at least one of you is simultaneously laughing and crying. Echoing a handful of letters, Jenny Heimberg of Alexandria, Virginia writes, I thought it was over or that I was safe at least until January 20th, but it happened again while listening to the post-election song mix during last week's broadcast. That mix of songs made me stop what I was doing and break down into yet another sappy, silly, but joyous crying spell. P.S. Hi, John. Well, I didn't really actually expect my sister-in-law to be writing into the show, but that's cool. Hi, Jenny. We have links to all those stories that we referenced. You can listen to them back again and kind of gauge your own emotions, see what you think, see how you feel, and kind of share in this online cathartic experience that we can all have together. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? Keep those letters coming. We love to hear from you. Go to weekendamerica.org and let us know all of your emotions.
We'll
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Is there a chill in the air yet where you live? I was waiting for a bus downtown the other night, and I called my wife, and she thought I was having a medical emergency, but I had to explain to her that that's just how I talk when it's 14 degrees and I'm waiting for a bus and I've forgotten my hat. There's nothing wrong. That's just me, cold. Oh, and Tucson and San Diego and Orlando, I don't want to hear about it from any of you guys, okay? We still have a couple of weeks until the official start of the season, December 21st, but come on, it's winter. And we're going to explore the changing of the seasons here now, starting with poet Linda Gregg. And although Linda's lived in different winter climates, like the mild, balmy air of Greece and the cool, snowy days of Massachusetts, winter reminds her most of growing up on the West Coast.
Well, my homeland is Northern California, West Marin County, and they have four seasons, but only people with a lot of sensitivity would understand the difference. I mean, for instance, in West Marin, winter has green grass and summer has blonde, you know? There's no snow, and there's more water in the creeks. In the summer, there's less water in the creeks. I think for somebody who lived in true winter, it's not in high contrast the way, say, a northern world would be with snow and very short nights. So it's a little softer. My father owned about 1,000 acres in West Marin, and I used to walk in this valley a lot. I'd walk along the creek all the way up through the valley, and then on the way back, I'd walk down the middle of the valley where it was more open to the sky. There was a time in winter in which all the salmon would spawn, and because I walked there all the time, there would just be a day in winter in which all of a sudden there were a million salmon just bruised, dying, and rushing up the creeks that were now full of water because it was winter. And for you people in the far north, this won't seem very wintry to you, but for us in that homeland, this was winter. Death looks down. Death looks down on the salmon, a male and a female in two pools, one above the other. The female turns back along the path of water to the male, does not touch him, and returns to the place she had been. I know what death will do. Their bodies already are sour and ragged. Blood has risen to the surface under the scales. One side of his jaw is unhinged. Death will pick them up, put them under his coat against his skin, and belt them there. We'll walk away up the path through the bay trees, through the dry grass of California to where the mountain begins, where a few deer, almost the color of the hills, will look up until he is under the trees again and the road ends, and there is a gate. He will climb over that with his treasure. It will be dark by then. But for now, he does nothing. He does not disturb the silence at all, nor the occasional sound of leaves, of ferns touching, of grass or stream. For now he looks down at the salmon, large and whole, motionless days and nights in the cold water, lying still, always facing the constant motion.
Linda Gregg reading from her new book, All of It Singing. You can read her poem, Death Looks Down, at weekinamerica.org. We have some pretty cool poetry animation there, too. So, poetry is good for the mind this winter, but you got to get a workout for the body as well. You can ski, snowboard, go inside and play basketball, maybe, or you could curl. Maybe you've seen curling on the Olympics, you know, sheet of ice, big things that look like irons pushed down the ice toward targets. The iron things are called stones or rocks, by the way. The target area is the house, and people frantically sweep the ice in front of the stones. The object of the game? Simple. Score points. There are two teams, each with four players. One person throws the stone, two sweep in front of it, and sweeping makes the stone glide straighter and further toward the house. Remember, that's the target. Each player throws two stones per round, and the stone closest to the center of the target gets a point. If you have two stones closer than your competitors, you get 2 points. Three stones, 3 points. You get the picture. Curling season is now in full swing, and the biggest curling club in the United States is here in St. Paul, and it's run by longtime curler Jim Dex Dexter. I paid Dex a visit to get a few pointers. Well, Dex, somehow I've made it to this point in life never having curled. Can you show me how to... I want to learn how to throw a stone, and I want to learn how to sweep.
There's basically like a captain or a skip at the far end that reads the ice, which doesn't make much sense, but that the ice will curl and react differently in different spots of the sheet ice.
So the skip down at the end is
going to... dictating the game. There's actually a thin vapor it'll leave on top of the ice. As you can see, the ice has got like an orange or has an orange peel effect on it called pebbling, like a fancy...
It's not one smooth sheet.
You couldn't throw a rock down one end or the other. We've tried it without the pebble. And what it does, it gets the rock off the ice. There's, you know, literally thousands of the little pebbles, and we re-pebble every game, and the rocks actually ride on that pebble. But we got to find you guys a broom.
All right.
And we're going to have you guys throw it. Because that's the best way to figure out what's going on in this goofy game.
Are we going to throw first and then sweep?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let's start with the throwing.
Right-handers put their right foot in the left hack, we call them.
All right.
And then you'd get down.
It's like, it's like on a track and field, like I'm going to start running.
Exactly. All right. The exact same principle. Get down in like a catcher's position, like you're going to catch a baseball. Sit all the way down. Relax. Get comfortable.
Okay.
At your age, I see you get down real easy.
Oh, yes.
What we want you to do, we're going to use this broom for balance. And you kind of want a feeling like a tripod on a camera.
All right.
And then you elevate your hips. Up, bring it back like this.
Uh-huh.
Bring this foot with it. And start the rock first and then throw it out. You have to throw one so we kind of go from there.
Oh, okay.
Such a strange motion. Now, on good ice, that may go too far already, but on good ice, that would definitely be too heavy.
Really?
Which means it's traveling too far.
Don't kill my joy here, Dex. I almost put the rock in the house.
I was just going to say, what are you doing tonight at 5? We need a sub. You're in.
Should we practice? Should you teach me some sweeping?
I'm going to teach you how to sweep,
okay.
Which is a unique thing.
Now, that broom has no bristles upon it.
No, they used to make them with bristles. They used to actually do it with an old-fashioned, look like a garage broom nowadays. But so the sweeping's evolved, like the game and the precision of the rocks. And it's just the principle of the harder and faster you can sweep right in front of the stone, the more effective you are.
And that'll speed up the stone.
And no, it doesn't speed it up. Less friction, it'll travel further.
It'll travel further. That's what I meant to say.
Yeah.
It'll travel further.
You're a rookie. We'll forgive you.
You know, I'm just now learning to put the rock in the house.
We can give you terminology, a little chip and lie or hit and roll, or you want to come down under, make a double or triple or whatever. I mean, we can throw a whole bunch of terms, and I can sound real smart because you have no idea what I'm saying.
You could be making up terms for all I know.
But the problem is I'm not. So, and when they sweep, the skip will normally yell, hurry, hurry, hard, hard, sweep, sweep, anything like that. And then you got to remember, yep, that's right.
If I'm right-handed, I'm holding this.
Hold this arm in and kind of move the broom. And it's real easy to do when you're standing still. I'll just fire this down here, and this is kind of get. So you start moving, I'll throw it, then you sweep it. That's about how fast the rock would go. Okay. Sweep. Come on, hurry, hard. Come on, hurry.
I hit the rock. Yeah. I'm a natural, aren't I?
So far, you look like a natural. Like I said, I do need a sub at 5.
I got to say, Dex, I thought the sweeping would be easier than the throwing.
Yeah, it's not.
No, it's exhausting.
It really is. It's amazing. Now, I've been lucky enough to go out to the Colorado Springs Olympic Training Center. And one of the amazing things they found out about sweeping, it's the fastest instant heart rate of any winter sport. Now, to think that you got to be in shape like a downhill skier or a hockey player or a skater is not true, but it is a good cardiovascular. It's good for that. So that's kind of why they call it a lifetime sport, and it does keep you active.
Okay. I think I was born to sweep.
Well, you do look like a natural. I'll give you credit for that.
Can you call me Sweepy? If I come down in club, will everyone call me Sweepy?
Yep. Well, I really think that was that or Sleepy. I'm not really
sure.
Okay.
Yeah, well.
One or the other. Go, Sweepy.
Dex tells me that the club just spent $80,000 for new stones. $80,000. They were pulled from a special mine on the island of Elsie Craig, Scotland, which is supposed to have the best granite in the world for curling stones. We have pictures of my trip to the club online. Learn how I earned the name Sweepy. You can check them out at weekendamerica.org. The Alberta Clipper is coming to America. No, not, that's not a Canadian sailboat. It's a low-pressure weather system moving south from Canada into the Great Lakes. Low temperatures, snow on the way. Here with more weather and fun is Jeannie Yandel.
In the 19th century, logging companies sent men into the forests for months. Workers lived in camps and weren't allowed to go home for holidays. Sounds fun, says Grand Rapids, Minnesota, at their logging camp Christmas. See lumberjacks at work, eat in the cook tent, and visit with flannel Santa. Snowy and 16. Maybe this should be, let's set all this lumber on fire to keep warm Christmas jamboree. Winter in Oregon means less than 8 hours of light per day. Portland says that's perfect beer weather at Holiday Ale Fest. Try locally brewed beers, which, let's be honest, will probably all taste the same after the first few. 40 degrees and rainy, so hopefully all that beer will make you feel invincible and waterproof. Or just take an umbrella, drinky. Alabama is known for crawfish and capturing the admiration of Lynyrd Skynyrd and the enmity of Neil Young. It is not known for snow, but Foley, Alabama ignores the laws of science at Let It Snow Fest. Sunny and 65 degrees, I see a problem here, Foley, for the promise of lots of real snow. Also, storytelling, music, and disappointment. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Country music is known for a lot of things. It's known for broken hearts, it's known for whiskey, it's known for lonesomeness. But Muslims? Not so much. Until now. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The annual Hajj gets underway today in Saudi Arabia. About 3 million Muslims are in Mecca as part of the 5-day spiritual pilgrimage, which all Muslims are supposed to make at least once in their lifetimes. Kareem Salama hopes to go on the Hajj someday, but right now he's busy working on an album, a country music album. Kareem grew up in northeast Oklahoma, and that world gives him his musical inspiration. And so does his Islamic faith. Producer Kyle Gassett has our story.
Kareem Salama spent a lot of time at the rodeo
and drove a Silverado pickup truck to high school. When he was little, he knew exactly what he wanted to be.
I always like wore, I remember I had like a black cowboy hat, and I used to wear my boots, and I always used to wear the, you know, the cowboy neckties. I was pretty into that kind of thing.
As for music, Cream's favorites were Garth Brooks, Reba McEntire, Tanya Tucker, and Alabama.
I mean, country music's like crickets, you know, in Oklahoma. It's just there. I mean, you don't really know, it's not really whether you like it or you don't. It's just part of, you know, it's just part of the culture.
But listening to country music isn't enough for Cream Salama. He wants to be a star. He's already recorded 2 albums and just got back from a European tour.
I want to live in a land called paradise. I want to go to the valley of the king. I want to live in a land called paradise. Want to see the birds fly and I want to hear the angels sing the praises of my...
Cream's parents are engineers from Egypt, and they immigrated to Ponca City, Oklahoma to work in the oil business. At first, slow-talking Okies drove his mom crazy. But Kareem was born in Oklahoma, and he says no one can stop him from loving it.
So we were walking back from, I think, from Walmart. I mean, given it was Oklahoma, it had to be Walmart. These rednecks, they drove by, and they were like, they saw my, because my mom wears a headscarf, and they were like, go home. And I was, it was like around kindergarten, so I was learning, you know, you have to stand up and say your address. So I was like, we are going home, 400 Wren Drive, Ponca City, Oklahoma, 74604. You know, so it was like I didn't really register what they meant by go home, as in go home back to some place across the ocean.
Even now, Kareem manages to stay calm in tough situations. In May of last year, Fox News' Neil Cavuto called Kareem to be on his show, right after 6 Middle Eastern immigrants were caught planning an attack on Fort Dix, New Jersey.
So how does that make folks like my next guest feel? Kareem Salama is a Muslim country music star here in the United States, and you fit a profile.
Yeah.
Does that bother you?
I mean, I see both sides of the argument. I mean, on one side, you've got a distinct profile in that they're Muslim. The problem is that's a slippery slope. You can start profiling people if there's a statistical correlation between a certain race or a certain religion with how many people are with them.
Throws wet stones at me, insists on attempts to break my nerve. But I hate to respond to the anger and feed the fuel in those ugly words. They ask me why I say nothing at all, like I don't have any self-respect. I say, gentlemen, I'm lacking sense. The more you burn me, the more I'm fragrant.
The song you're hearing now, Generous Peace, is probably the first time ancient Arabic poetry has made its way into country music. Kareem translated this verse written by 8th century poet Imam Shafi.
But I lace the lines of these times with generous peace. Oh, with generous peace.
And he says, he increases in his assault on me, and I increase in my tolerance of him, for I'm like incense. The more you burn me, the more fragrant I become. And I thought that idea of, like, you know, burning incense and it just keeps giving out a more beautiful smell was awesome.
Kareem hears no dissonance between his background and the super patriotic tendencies of mainstream country music. Nobody sounds more country than he does when he starts talking about terrorists.
Muslims, they suffered things like 9/11 and 7/7. You know, they suffer when they see innocent people dying and innocent people who are their own countrymen. But at the same time, they suffer the sort of heightened scrutiny that now, you know, people somehow think that we actually sympathize with those people when we absolutely abhor those people. So nobody would want to put a boot in their ass more than I'm wearing boots, you know, and these boots were made for putting a boot in terrorist ass.
This is no act. I grew up in a West Texas oil town, pretty much the same part of the world that Kareem did. And by the way, he sits up in his chair, even leans forward a little bit when he talks about this. You know he means business. He also has that same tough guy approach to his fellow immigrants who complain about life here.
A lot of people blame, you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, people didn't like me because I was, you know, my parents were foreign or my grandparents were foreign or I was Muslim or this. And I always, like, say, you know, maybe you were just a dork. You know, maybe instead of blaming, you know, other people, maybe you should look and ask yourself, and maybe you just weren't cool. I swear there's more
for us to do. Right now, Kareem Salaam is working on a new album to be released next year. He's hoping that it'll push him onto mainstream country radio, add a new audience along the way, and get him a little closer to his dream. I'm Kyle Gassett for Weekend America. This life of mine, this life of mine, ain't the life I had in mind. But if I'm bold enough, wise enough, that I can make this life worthwhile, I can make this life worth smiling.
That's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, a show that you help produce. True, you don't have an office here in St. Paul yet, but we rely on you to help build the show. You're the America in the Weekend America. There are links at weekendamerica.org for upcoming stories we're working on. You can also become a fan of Weekend America on Facebook. Just search for us on that site. You'll find us. Get updates on the show, topics for future segments. You can share thoughts. You can share photos. There's a kind of a cool, interesting one up there now of a lady riding a big fake elk. We're on Twitter, too, twitter.com/theweekend. Sign up to follow us and get updates on the show as it comes together each week. I love reading what people are up to on their weekends on Twitter. Jerry is doing some holiday shopping and then going to the Missouri-Oklahoma game tonight. I am jealous of Jerry. We hear from Deesh, who is making butter chicken with Indian rice and a whole lot of it. Yum. That's at twitter.com/theweekend. You can download a free podcast of our entire show at weekendamerica.org. Enjoy your weekend. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Saving lives when others are out on the town. I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, go behind the scenes at an emergency room where the situations and the people you deal with are anything but routine.
Many patients who come into the emergency room are difficult. They're intoxicated, they're belligerent, they're angry, and so things happen and you just sort of have to roll with it.
A weekend shift at Massachusetts General Hospital. Join us.